I've been trying to book today's guest since at least last September, and I finally got him. William Grider has been right for so long about so many things that last fall I wanted his take on the emerging financial crisis and the prospects of Barack Obama's being elected. Well, once both of those things happened, I've wanted to talk with him about how we got here, what we need to do to deal with the crisis, what a true progressive platform for turning things around would look like. So get comfortable, if that's possible these days, and listen to a wise and passionate advocate of true democracy, a sustainable American dream, and a fair and forward-looking global society. Now national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, William Grider has spent 40 years examining how powerful institutions affect ordinary people. For 17 years, he was the national affairs editor at Rolling Stone magazine. He's a former assistant managing editor at The Washington Post, where he worked for 15 years as a national correspondent, editor, and columnist. He's the author of several national bestsellers, One World Ready or Not, Secrets of the Temple, Who Will Tell the People. Grider also served as correspondent for six Frontline documentaries on PBS, including Return to Beirut, which won an Emmy in 1985. He wrote the introduction to the just-released Meltdown, How Greed and Corruption Shattered Our Financial System and How We Can Recover, by the editors of The Nation, led by Katrina Vandenhoevel. And his next book, Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country, comes out later this month. Welcome, William Grider.
Thank you, Terrence, for that very nice introduction.
Well, you're very welcome.
You're so upbeat. That's nice. You must be on the West Coast.
Yep, here I am. You know, I've only been into this miserable day. I've been into this miserable day 3 hours shorter than you have,
that's
you see.
True. That's true. Well, the news is coming your way.
Okay.
It's not good.
Yeah. For Tom Daschle, among others, but
he's in a crack, isn't he?
Yeah. But let me ask you something, because I actually, you've been on before, but I like listeners to get a feel for the people, and my sense is they've already gotten a little feel for you. But I have a question. You graduated Princeton in 1958.
Yeah.
Ralph Nader, same school, 1955. What was it about that campus at that time that made it such a breeding ground for progressives?
That's where the revolution was plotted, right? You know who else was there? There were a bunch of really good people there, some of us working together on the campus newspaper. One of them was Jim Ridgway.
Oh, my God.
Of the Village Voice and lately Mother Jones. Another was Robert Caro, who was a class ahead of me, who the
biographer of Lyndon Johnson.
Biographer of LBJ
and
other books. And, you know, this was that post-war window where the older institutions of America were loosening up slightly. And so I think a lot of us got into Princeton then as kind of an experiment. Could high school kids do this? As opposed to fine, East Coast prep schools.
Right, right. In other words, public high school kids versus the kids from Andover,
yeah,
Exeter,
right.
Groton.
And I was one of those who struggled, and I mean really struggled, to not get thrown out for inadequacy. But it was good, it was that post-war glowing period in American life, which is really the beginning of the era that I think is coming to an end now. And this is what I write in my new book, and it's hard for people to quite absorb that reality. But it started with the victory in World War II, and followed through a number of really prosperous decades in which America got a bit closer to its ideal, that is, closer to an equitable society. And then for the last 30-plus years, a lot of it was unwound.
Yeah, yeah. I had Robert Shearer on when his book Super Capitalism came out. Mm-hmm. And in it, he makes pains to say that was not really a golden age, but
those post-war years,
right? I mean, we know in terms of civil rights, in terms of women's rights, in terms of gender rights, etc. There were huge problems in our society, but But it was a time, he points out, and we're going probably up until 73, which is it was from World War II to 73, real wages for Americans rose. Yeah. They haven't really ever since. But he says that there were countervailing forces. There was some sort of a balance in society of unions and corporations and government and civic associations and so on that seemed to work.
Well, and even the, you know, the civil rights movement, and believe me, I grew up utterly ignorant and innocent of the racial realities in this country, and then suddenly it was before us in a way that very few Americans could evade. That was a very creative period, and you could argue it's not over, but it had a certainly a peak last fall with the election of a black president.
Yeah,
and the country in economic terms, amid that prosperity, where most people, not everybody, but most people had a rising standard of living, and in a generous mood for a time, the country actually confronted poverty, and there was also, you know, a long list of important legislative accomplishments. I suggest, and my book is not history, but I think to understand where we are now, it helps to start back there and recognize this arc of history that we've been through as a country, because everything is going to change. It's already changing, but it's going to change more profoundly, I think, than people yet fully appreciate.
Okay,
and that's not gloom and doom. I mean, it's going to be hard, very hard, but it doesn't have to turn out to be decline and fall. Quite the opposite.
Yeah, I think it calls for and has the possibility of transformation.
Yes.
Let's jump up right now to the present. Your take on the stimulus package, because as I say, we'll get back to Come Home America, we'll get back to some of the bigger issues over history, but let's jump to the present.
Well, the first thing people, I think, need to understand is that it's extraordinary, in both in its size and in its content. We have a lot of money on the table, most of which overwhelmingly devoted to weaknesses, shortcomings, evasions that this country has been stuck on for more than 8 years, frankly, going back in the 90s. And it was either politically impossible to accomplish these things, or we were told we didn't have the money, and et cetera, et cetera. And that ranges everything from just in strengthening the aid programs for people who are down on their luck, or the poor, food stamps, employment benefits. You go on.
William, if I can, I actually have a list right here. So if anyone is waking up and kind of has gone, oh, they're doing something with the stimulus package, and now's the time when the Republicans are going to try to attack it. Let me just quickly tell people what's in it so that you realize what you said, which is not only is it large, but it's quite amazing. $142 billion middle-class tax cut, $47 billion extended unemployment benefits, $16 billion expand food stamps, $17 billion one-time payments to low-income Americans, $26 billion expand access to health care, $87 billion help states pay for Medicaid, $24 billion modernize health information technology, $46 billion bridges and roads, $80 billion public education, $19 billion school construction, $14 billion make college more affordable, $32 billion clean energy.
And I don't know if you mentioned the weatherization thing.
I'm looking at it now, and it's not, you're talking about the green jobs, the retrofitting of things, which maybe shows up in that clean energy one. But in any case, that we, as you say, these are things that we haven't, we've said we didn't have the money for while we had money for the Iraqs.
Or enviros and others talked about them, and they had to just squeeze and plead and beg and scramble to get state and local governments to do something, and many of them have. but they don't have the resources the federal government has. And so now, I mean, this is both stimulus and also the beginning, only the beginning, of a national transformation in the way we use energy and what we consume and what we waste and so forth and so on. And a lot of it is very prosaic stuff. If you rescale buildings so that they don't waste so much energy, and that's not just homes but big office buildings, etc., you immediately reduce your dependence on oil and imports and so forth. At the same time, you are stimulating the economy because you're making jobs, and you're jump starting investments that, yes, should have happened a couple of decades ago, but now they're going to start.
Right, and as Van Jones points out, you know, you can't outsource a retrofit.
That's true. You can't do it in China. And there's just a lot of virtue in this package on that level. Having said all that, I have to add that as economic stimulus, overcoming the collapse in demand and incomes and employment and everything else, production, the package is inadequate. And I feel confident that the sponsors in the White House and elsewhere in the government understand that. And they will have to do more. But this isn't big enough, actually, to probably guarantee a recovery.
Right.
I hope I'm wrong about that, but I'm not alone, of course.
That's what I was going to say. You are not alone. As a matter of fact, just this morning, I found a quote from Van Jones, who I just mentioned, been on the show a few times and so on. He says, I fear that we may soon look back and say we missed a huge chance to go bigger and bolder. Very consonant with what you're saying. After all, there were three flaws with the old economy that has crashed. It favored consumption over production, debt over savings, and environmental damage over environmental renewal. Some parts of the stimulus package need to be more of the same, but we could waste a lot of money and time. Instead, we need a new direction for our economy. You can't jump, I love this line, you can't jump halfway across a chasm. You will just end up falling into the abyss. And that's sort of your fear. Now, when you said you're not alone, you hope it's not true, you're saying that this has to help, but for it to actually turn this sort of aircraft carrier of an economy around, it would need to be two or three times as large?
Yeah, that's what I wrote in The Nation, and I'm drawing on really smart people who happen to be Keynesian economists. There's still some left in this country at the Levy Institute at Bard College. And they've been very good over the last 15 years or more as I've followed their strategic analyses of what, you know, it's very straightforward. This is the demand in the economy, and this is the output, and what do you need to balance those two again? So there's much bigger change that has to happen, but my own perspective is, okay, we have a president who, unlike some of his predecessors, is a really smart guy.
Yeah.
He knows this. He must know it.
Right.
You know, if I know it, he knows it.
And so you think this is a down payment?
I don't even think he wants to say that. I think he wants to hope for the best, but when we get 3 months, 6 months out, And if the arrows are all still going in the wrong direction, he'll have to respond politically, and I think people will be all over him to encourage him to do that, and so they'll try more. They'll do something more. They'll do some different things. I think what's so both exciting and a little frightening about our situation now is that this really is truly a dynamic political process where be careful what you predict because this thing is rolling now on its own momentum. The errors and outrages and frauds were already committed and they're baked into the situation. And so I think the government, I hope the government, we'll keep trying to invent the right set of answers, and that will probably require it to put still more money on the table.
Right. In other words, when I read your thing about two to three times smaller, I thought, what would be happening right now if Obama were asking for $2.4 trillion instead of $800
billion. Well, he would stop hearts around the Congress, for starters, and then probably elsewhere in the world as well. One of the points I make in that piece is that, first of all, beyond scale, the financial system is still dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest boys, mainly in Wall Street, leading firms and names, are still tottering, if not already insolvent, right on the edge. And the rest of the banking system is seized up by some of the same reasons, but also a quite natural response of bankers, which is when things are going down, the economy's contracting, there aren't a lot of good customers for loans. There are a lot of people who need loans, but that's not the banker's test. It's whether they can pay them back. And so lending is frozen. We are waiting now for the Obama answer to that, and the Treasury and Lawrence Summers in the White House and others are behind the door trying to construct a new plan for financial bailout, rescue, recovery. A lot of people are chewing on that and making their opinions known. I've sort of held my fire until we hear what actually they have to propose, and that's neither hopeful nor pessimistic. I think let's wait a few days or weeks, whatever it takes, before they tell us.
And what you're saying is
they've got to do something different. We know.
Right. What you're saying is this: you just switched from talking about the proposed stimulus
to
the second half of the $700 billion, and how is that going to be different than the first half?
Yeah.
One basic point that I found in a lot of your recent writing, again, you're not the only one to say it, but you've said it forcefully, is that the people who've been making decisions so far, Bush, Paulson, Bernanke, even Obama and Geithner, don't seem to have been asking this question: how do we save the folks? What can we do to help individuals and families in pain? It seems that they stop short of that. They ask about what can we do to open up credit? What can we do to affect banks, which seems to me are just all means to an end. Do you think they'd be asking different questions, coming up with different answers, if they asked the more basic question?
I think so. I mean, I have written more than once in the last 6 months, the financial system, the banking system, are not going to get well until the economy has life back in it, the real economy of producers, consumers, workers, etc. And obviously the two have to go together, but I think they literally started on the wrong end and saw this quite narrowly as a crisis of financiers and bankers, which indeed it is. But they made their mess, and we're all suffering as a result. But they are not going to restore vigor to the real economy because for their own self-interest, but also they don't have the wherewithal to do that. So the real economy stimulus is the first, to me, basic initiative to turn things around. The financial system absolutely has, you probably know, I again said for some months, you're not going to get these guys to do the right thing until you nationalize them. And that sounds pretty scary to a lot of people, but it's not really that radical. What I'm saying is the government should temporarily, whether that means 6 months or 2 years or 3 years or whatever it takes, take a control, a kind of receivership status of the entire financial system, and I'm including people who are not bank holding companies in that, and direct them in their behavior, and then sort through them and say, this one is basically gone. We will manage its liquidation. And here I'm talking about some big names like Citigroup. Sell off its parts or keep its banks open and let them operate as banks, but no more adventures.
Mm-hmm. In other words, they become the more simple bank they used to be.
Absolutely.
And lending to people.
In the process, whether Obama or anybody else likes it or not, the government is going to have to reformulate the banking system and the financial system. That's a long, complex subject, but they are, in effect, doing that now, perhaps inadvertently or perhaps unwittingly.
Yeah, but let me read
by trying to save the failures.
Right. Let me just read
backwards to me.
Yeah. Arianna Huffington had a piece this morning in which she said, as Bloomberg has reported, Henry Paulson invested twice as much taxpayer money in Goldman Sachs as Warren Buffett did, and gained warrants that were worth one-fourth as much.
And I wrote that piece in The Nation.
And Stiglitz said if he were still an employee of Goldman Sachs and made that deal, he'd have been fired.
Yeah, sure.
So that's really, I mean, what you're saying is that there, well, and it goes back to, it's another play sort of on what Van Jones said about going halfway.
Well,
right? In other words, they're afraid to say the word nationalized, or they're afraid to put government influence on the table?
I think they're afraid of the latter, for sure, but I think they're also under the spell, and here I am careful to exempt Barack Obama, because we don't yet know where he's coming out. But the government regulators, and I think to a large extent the Congress, are under the spell of these major leading Wall Street banks have been such powerful players in the U.S. economy, and not to mention the rest of the world. And so they, naturally, we have to save them. We have to restore them. And I think if they stop and say, well, you know, how would we get along without Citigroup?
Right.
That'd mean a lot of loss for lots of people, investors and so forth and so on, and not to mention employees. But this country would not, you know, roll up and die after that. We would find a way to get through, and that's why I think government control is probably an unavoidable step. And I'm only guessing that this president will try to avoid that step a while longer.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what I'm hoping, Terry, and I feel sure something like this is happening. Larry Summers and Tim Geithner will bring their plan to the president, and they'll kick it around and change things and so forth and so on. And then if the president says, okay, we're going with your plan, which is, by my lights, some sort of halfway grab bag, but I want to hear another plan from you. What do we do when this plan fails? And that's not an accusation.
It's sort of
a good executive saying, "All right, I'm buying your proposal, but you got to give me an exit strategy."
Right, right. In other words, if this is the best we can do right now,
it can't be 2 years from now.
Yeah.
It's got to be something, because we'll know soon enough whether you guys are right or not, and that's. This is what I'm hoping for in this president, and there's a lot of basis for hoping for it. He has his eyes open. He's brilliant in sort of timing the ability to do things that maybe 3 months or 3 years earlier nobody would have dared do. He did that as a candidate.
Exactly.
He's doing it now in different ways as president. If he keeps that spirit up front, and keeps telling the public, okay, we're going to try something different here because the last thing didn't work as well as we thought it would. And here's what I'm telling you. This may not work either. We're going to keep trying.
Yeah.
If he governs in that spirit, I think the American people will be with him and will stay with him. And this is what I hope for.
Okay, we're going to, on that note, we're going to end part one.